Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and turning our attention now to the weather with Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison. He's also a professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences. And John Martin, professor and chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. Great to have them back. And if you have a weather-related question, I hope you will join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And also go to our Facebook page. Please do that. Go to the Larry Mueller Show, because there are oftentimes there are photos, weather-related photos put up, and questions come from there. And you can pose a question or even a photo from that page. Steve, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It's great to be back again.
And John, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Larry.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, let's go right to the Facebook page, because we've got a here's a picture that a person sent wondering what you thought of that cloud formation.
It's beautiful. That's what
beautiful.
I think.
I think it's beautiful too. I think it looks like a horse, a little bit like
a
dragon. Those are the wings with
a giant castle.
Right.
You know.
But so that's definitely, I mean, that's definitely a cumulus type cloud. It's that cirrus, like wing thing. If you think of it as a dragon, right? That's what I'm thinking of it as now. That seems kind of odd to be coming out of that. It's almost like you would get at the top of an active
storm.
Yeah,
I wonder if it's coming out, if it's detrained somewhere near the top of that set of turrets.
At the lower ones.
Yeah, and then something else built on top of it, or it's behind it. They might actually not be one giant congestus.
Oh, that could be.
It's
it
possible,
could be a perspective thing.
Yeah. But it's really awesome. I mean,
picture.
I'm sure if you really saw that live, it would be even more breathtaking
right.
picture. It's just that the scale of these things is remarkable.
It definitely is a beautiful, beautiful shot.
Did he leave anything about where he was looking? Doesn't look that way.
No, Brian said just fascinating cloud formation, and it definitely is that.
We won't argue that.
No.
Right? Yeah.
Well, we'll handle some more photos or more questions off the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. If you would like, please go to that page and post something. Well, I tell you guys, spring usually means severe weather. So now we're into summer. We had a pretty active spring, I think.
A pretty active spring.
That's safe to say. That's safe territory.
Both the state and the nation.
Yeah.
I mean, the state, I think, has had 27. I don't know if they've all been confirmed, but 27 tornadoes.
Tornadoes?
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Normally we have 21. And we've still got a couple of months yet.
Country's had over 1,200. And annual average is, I think, 1,100 for a season. So we're already surpassed that. The record is about 1,800, I think, and we may surpass that with the season going till the end of August or thereabouts.
Somebody was wondering or asked the question, what is a tornado exactly, and how does it form, and why? And then, again, going along with what you're talking about, why we have so many.
Mm. Yeah. Tornado is a vertically oriented column of rapidly rotating air, so that's one thing you can call it. They form in thunderstorm environments that are characterized by a couple of really essential ingredients. One of them is strong differences in the wind speed and direction with height, what we call vertical shear. There has to be significant vertical shear in the environment for an ordinary thunderstorm to work on that shear and turn it into a vertically rotating column and manifest as a tornado. And the atmosphere has to be fairly poorly stratified, that is, susceptible to the quick development of deep convective thunderstorm weather. So those two major ingredients are factors that have to be around for tornadoes. In the central part of the United States, it's very easy in the spring and the early summer to manufacture the stability part of the ingredients. And then if significant jet stream features are migrating across the latitudes of Oklahoma, northern Texas, then that provides the vertical wind shear ingredient. Climatologically, they occur with great enough frequency that we get about 1,100 a year. But this particular spring, we've had a really unusual frequency of strong jet features across that part of the country. I would say, if I had to put a real reason, I'd say that's the reason. The jet has been stronger and more persistent over that part of the country than it usually is.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, and that's basically why we have more in the Plain States than we do. Tend to have more in the Plain States than elsewhere.
Yeah, that's right. The proximity of the Gulf of Mexico to the Mexican Plateau provides ingredients that provide that instability that is really essential for the thunderstorm development.
We have Gary in Wausau has a question for you guys, so let's go there. Hi, Gary.
Hi there. Hey, I've got a question about the clouds. They're just gases, I believe, correct, and minerals, and if so and such. We as humans, do we create any clouds, such as like the atom bomb or nuclear bombs? Do they create clouds? I mean, we do see the cloud structure of it. So is that something that stays in the atmosphere that just continues to rotate around the Earth?
So the clouds are actually particles of liquid water or of ice-type crystals. And we do generate clouds, although they don't stay around forever. And the ones I'm thinking about in particular are contrails. So the linear clouds that come out of jets as that hot, moist air mixes with the cooler environment, we can generate a cloud. That's one way. But they'll last, though I've seen them actually last for several hours, or they can last for just a few seconds. It really depends on what the large-scale atmosphere conditions are like.
Yeah, the humidity in the vicinity of them. But the famous mushroom clouds, they are also water and ice clouds, and they're formed by the really strong updrafts of air that are a result of the explosion. So that water is processed very quickly by the atmosphere, and so the clouds won't last forever, but they're produced by an extreme example of the updrafts that produce normal clouds.
Yeah, and actually, forest fires, really fires will also generate clouds on the very top of them.
Yeah, really interesting phenomenon. Yep.
Pyrocumulus, I think,
they're called. Yeah, pyrocumulus, and they can, in fact, rain.
Right.
It's really interesting.
Yeah. It's going to be muddy rain, probably. Yeah. Dirty rain.
Yeah, it's got a lot of ash in it and stuff, yeah.
Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. You can join in, too, with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show. How have our temperatures this last spring seemed to be all over? I mean, we were at 90-some degrees, and then we went practically to freezing.
Yeah. And amazing. And at the time when we were suffering those days with highs around 50 or whatever they were, in late May or mid-May, places just a couple hundred miles south of us were already in the depths of their summer. St. Louis was near 90 or above many of those days when we were really chilly. So there was a persistent boundary between Madison and central Missouri that just kept it, bouncing back and forth from cold to warm for a couple of weeks or 3 weeks there from late May to early June. And I don't know, this week portends to be pretty warm and summery, muggy-like. Mm-hmm. So we'll be back to that. But it's been a kind of a whirlwind this spring.
But when you average it all out, we're about average.
Yeah.
It doesn't, see it. And this is why climate is more than averages, right? It's extremes as well. Because those really hot days really leveled things out.
They did.
And so the central and northern parts of the state didn't have quite the same, or did they?
I think the whole state
of the state was
warm.
The whole state was pretty warm.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. It's the northern part didn't get as much precip as the southern part, I think, yeah.
Dave in Augusta, on to you now. Hi, Dave. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, guys. My question is regarding the barometric pressure. Mm. When the barometer is moving up or down, when I'm muskie fishing in northern Wisconsin, I'll notice that the fish are more active. It's easier to catch a muskie. It's a great time to be out. Mm. As long as you're not out into the storm itself. Now, when there's a front moving in, the fish become more active. Do you have any explanation for that, or why that would be?
And I can certainly second that. I've had much more success in situations where you've got an approaching storm. The activity just gets much greater. Mm.
Yeah, I looked this up a couple of years ago because I started taking up bass fishing and was wondering the same thing. And there's actually been a lot of studies to look at what might be causing the fish, in terms of pressure, to become more active. And there's no real evidence one way or the other. I mean, they were thinking it might have to do with the ballast of the fish, but it turns out that that wasn't the case. So it's not clear. And the only thing I would say is it seems to work.
Yeah.
And it works.
And as a summertime event, weather event approaches, then the air is a little bit less stably stratified and warmer at the surface. I wonder if it doesn't excite insects and other kinds of prey. And that maybe the fish over a long period of time are not particularly sensitive to the pressure, but sensitive enough that something gets that registers between, hey, I'm feeling it in my sinuses. I think there'll be more bugs up there.
Up there, right? I wonder. I don't know. It's something I've wondered about for a long time and have no answer.
So we don't have an answer, but we know it works, Dave.
You bet it does, Larry. Thanks again.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Jennifer in Fish Creek, on to you now. Hi, Jen.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, because I'm driving in my car. Look, I just have to say, I don't know if you were talking, just flipped my radio on, so I don't know if you were talking about this or not. The white lines that are up in the sky that stay there all day. Have you already talked about that?
We just mentioned it in terms of they're generated by aircraft, jets.
Mm-hmm. They're generated by what?
By jet aircraft. So airplanes.
Commercial aircraft?
Generally high-flying aircraft. So nowadays, mostly that is certainly commercial, although these contrails, we call them, condensation trails, really became a big thing in World War II. And they were being generated by bombers, you know. So clearly, if you're on the ground, you look up.
I'm not talking about World War II. I'm talking about on holidays when there should be extreme commercial travel. The skies are pure blue, but on like other days when there should be like not a lot of commercial travel, there is. I've counted them before, 20, 30, 40. In consecutive lines, crisscrossing patterns all over the sky. It is impossible that those are commercial jet craft. They have to be military, and they are leaving giant plumes of white substance in the sky that if anybody looks up, it spreads over the sky and turns the sunny day completely overcast.
Yet there's two things to get these contrails. One is you need aircraft. That's a necessary condition, but it's not a sufficient. The other thing you need is the atmosphere in the altitudes that they're flying at to be at the right temperatures and the right humidities. And if they're at the right temperatures and right humidities, then you can get the contrails that, once they're generated, can stay around for hours. And so if you look at the number of planes that actually leave, for example, Chicago, you know, those are, there are, I mean, they're like every 5 minutes.
Yeah.
A plane.
And there's not much of a difference between holiday and non-holiday traffic, or Sunday and Friday.
Yeah. You need the atmospheric conditions are what determines whether or not a contrail will be visible and how long it'll stay around.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the alternative hypothesis that this is just a function of the varying atmospheric conditions against not very varying commercial aircraft conditions, and that leads to the day-to-day variance in how much of these contrails and how long they last occur in the sky. That's probably at least or more probable. Yeah.
Steve, thank you very much for calling, Jen. Appreciate it. Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys, will be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at weather and climate today with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Great to have them along. And certainly, if you have a question or comment, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And if you've got a photo share or question to ask on our Facebook page, that works too. Go to the Larry Mueller Show for that. And we had a actually a caller from Platteville, Gloria, couldn't stay on the line, but wondered what you guys think about whether heavy corn planting for ethanol, or I guess for anything for that matter, affects summer temperatures in Wisconsin. She read that it is making our summers cooler.
One thing corn does is it takes a lot of water out of the soils and put it up into the atmosphere. So I'm not sure it in comparison to a city, adding vegetation is going to make the temperature cooler. But with corn playing such a big role in transpiring water into the atmosphere, it's going to make it more humid, which makes it feel warmer.
That's definitely true. You can look at the dew point temperatures in small towns or even cities in Iowa, as opposed to parts of northern Illinois that aren't quite as agrarian. And the dew points on a day where otherwise everything's the same, otherwise, you have much bigger dew points in Iowa. In fact, there have been severe thunderstorm and tornado outbreaks that can really be traced back to something called dew point pooling. That is increasing the dew point very locally as a consequence of evapotranspiration from the corn. Corn is horribly bad at managing water. And so once it gets past knee-high about a week from now, it's really it turns Iowa into an inland sea. There's so much water coming out of the corn. It's amazing.
So I guess it depends if it's replacing city or just normal vegetated surfaces, regular farm field.
But I agree with Steve. The temperature isn't the first thing that comes to mind. It'd be the humidity and the level of discomfort.
Much higher.
Yeah, absolutely.
But a Facebook comment from Phil, going back to barometric pressure effect on fish, says, I used to raise butterflies and moths, and they always hatched within 24 hours of a storm. You can see it now. If you notice a lot of butterflies on a day, expect rain or a frontal passage within 24 hours. So fish food always hatches and flies about in large numbers just barely before a storm arrives.
Something tells me the fish have become aware of that over the eons.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, maybe there really is a food connection to this thing.
Right, but through really the insects, not a direct.
Right, yeah, not through their sinuses or whatever. Well, it could be that. Yeah. I would think that's where the pressure would register if it's going to. But
Do fish have noses? I guess they do.
Well, I guess so, in a way.
If they run into something, does their eyes water up? You know, if they boom.
It's the best way to prevent a shock attack is to punch it in the nose. They can't stand it.
Oh, that's
it.
Right,
Their whole nervous system gets screwed up by that, apparently, but probably not for long.
Right. And you don't want to miss. You get a little too low.
It's not an experiment I want to try.
No. Don't recommend doing that at home.
No. Oh, boy. 1-800-642-1234, the number to call. There's been some interesting observations of the sun recently. I don't know when you talk about that. Sunspots, decrease in sunspots, if I'm not mistaken. What does that mean, Steve?
Yeah, it's been, it just goes to show how little we know about our sun, even though it's been burning for billions of years, and we've been really studying it probably for about 2,000 years in terms of counting the number of sunspots. But we have recently come out of a quiet period of the sun where basically we had very few or no sunspots. So the sun runs through a 22-year cycle. It's an 11-year cycle in the number of sunspots, and then a 22 when you count the sunspots and the flipping of the magnetic fields that are associated with it. And we're supposed to be entering an active time of sunspots. And there was a recent article by NASA scientists saying that it hasn't been nearly as active as they have been predicting. Mm. So they're trying to figure out now what is going on. Why aren't we getting more sunspots than what was being anticipated? So it's a very, even though we're entering a more activity of the sun, it's not as active as previous years at this part of the cycle.
Wow, interesting.
Although I did also hear that there has been a coronal discharge. And so we should be getting like a solar flare reaching Earth around July 1, I think. Mm. So we may be keeping your ears open for Aurora Borealis, Northern Lights.
Yeah, I was just going to say Northern Lights then.
Yeah.
And there's a way to sign up for that. We brought this up in the past.
Spaceweather.com.
Spaceweather.com, and they will give you an alert.
They'll give you an email alert when you sign up for it.
I have not done that. I've got to do that.
I did it, and then it expired or something because then it stopped. I don't think they stopped the service.
They didn't give you an email alert for that, did they?
Oh, man. Let's see. We've got an email from Roxanne. Being a believer in global climate change, I'm always looking for ways to explain to skeptics how our weather is affected by the global climate. So many scoffers dispute it because it's not hot outside. I understand warm air holds more moisture, so understandably it would result in more rain and snowfall. Is there a better way to explain how it is impacting us now, today?
Difficult question to answer because if you look outside your window today or even over the next couple of days and you kind of take accurate accounting of the weather and then try to relate how that weather has been directly affected by a small perturbation to the global climate, you're really... it's a needle in a haystack sort of way to look at things. The better way to do it is to imagine, are there structures? And this is where, unfortunately, there's a gulf between the people who are not able to interrogate these things with professional tools the way Steve and I are every day because of our jobs, and people who are just enthusiasts about the weather. But you have to look at these kind of questions with professional tools, gridded data sets, looking at structures that occur in the atmosphere today and trying to understand whether those structures have some relationship to a changing climate. And that's a complicated question, which really can only be interrogated the right way with these kinds of tools that unfortunately not everybody has access to. It's difficult to answer that question.
And yeah, and we don't say it in a snobbish way either. This kind of reminds me of my brothers. You know, they're both in construction and things like that. When I tell them that I'm going to make something, you know, they just laugh at me. Like, you know, like, come on, this is not what you do. You know, leave it to us before you go ahead and sand down your wooden floors because, you know, you're going to wreck it. And, and I didn't listen. And I had to bring in a professional because I wrecked the floors. But yeah, I think I agree with John. It's sometimes and sometimes people don't want to listen, and that becomes the hard part. And so, you know, recently I've been thinking the National Academy of Sciences, which was set up by Lincoln in order to get nonpartisan input on science and its implications on society. You know, they address a lot of things, and they bring to scientists from you know, different areas of expertise, depending on the question that they're addressing, and they have to come to a consensus. And so when you take scientists from all over the country and you bring them in and you ask them about climate change and global warming, the consensus, which means consensus means everybody agrees, the consensus of that group of, you know, two dozen scientists say, yeah. And so it's, yeah, we got a problem.
Yeah. And you know, there are professional people out there in different professions, some of them politicians, who blur the line between, you know, science and assertion. And they make statements that assert one fact or another, according to them, and they're simply not well considered. That's a fair statement for us to make.
I can assert that I can redo my kitchen. But Anne, my wife, insisted we get somebody professional.
Right, that's right.
Jim and Brown Deer, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Good. It's kind of a follow-up question to the one you just answered. On the radio, I heard that the flooding in Minot, North Dakota,
yes,
was predicted because of global warming. Is there any justification for that statement that the heavy snowfall in Canada and the heavy rains is based on the fact that we now have global warming and the weather patterns are changing?
In my mind, I would say, what an interesting proposition. Let's investigate it. I can't imagine that the investigation of last winter's snowfall in the detail required to answer that question conclusively could already have been accomplished. So, in my opinion, that is a goofy statement for anybody to make.
Hmm. Okay. Is there research going to be done to see if there's any justification for this kind of climatological change?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, there will. In fact, we're looking at, in our own department, we're looking at questions not particularly related to the Missouri flooding and the flooding up in North Dakota, but the some of the severe weather we had this spring, as well as our big winter, our big windstorm here in the Central Plains from last October. Those may well be effects of a warmer climate, but in a very long path in the argument. It's not a direct consequence, sort of an indirect consequence, but we're investigating those kinds of questions, exactly.
If one wanted to follow up the research, where would one look?
Really good question.
That's a good question.
You know, you've made me think about this. Maybe it's time for us in our own department, perhaps, to start putting a bunch of papers and scholarly presentations and whatnot that actually pertain to this question somewhere readily accessible to people who are interested. That's a really good point.
Yeah,
okay, I'd appreciate that.
Yeah, that would be the place to go. We'll try and announce that.
Okay, yeah. Thank you very much.
You bet.
That's a great idea.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Dan in Janesville, let's turn to you next. Hi, Dan.
Hello, how you guys doing today?
Good.
I got a question about lightning. Last I really watched, I do a lot of, you know, Discovery Channel, stuff like that, but last time I watched something, it was about lightning. They understood what lightning was, but still didn't understand how it was created exactly. Has that been figured out yet or found, what exactly has to happen for lightning to occur?
I think the exact process, probably not. What they do know, though, is that you need to have ice within the cloud and probably, ice and also liquid water associated with some of the particles, whether they're pure liquid or if they're chunks of ice that have a layer, very thin layer of liquid water. So they know what those ingredients are in terms of you need those two things and you need them running up against each other and exchanging charges. But how that happens specifically and why do you get such a strong bolt as opposed to a general diffusion is still stuff that I think they're trying to work out.
Yeah, I think that's about
okay.
right.
And they're learning new types of lightning. I mean, there used to be what we call just positive lightning. And it depended on the charges. Like generally we had negative charges near the cloud base and positive near the ground. But there is such a thing as negative lightning, which it kind of reverses that kind of relationship between the charges around. And it's lightning that comes out the tops of clouds. So there's red sprites now and blue jets and elves. And we don't know what causes that stuff.
Yeah. It's really weird.
Interesting. We have, thanks a lot for calling, Dan. Appreciate it. We have from Anastasia, who has emailed a photo. It's up actually up on our Facebook page. This picture captured earlier this year by my mom, Margie, from Shawano, Wisconsin. She says it hadn't rained for an hour before or after these photos were taken. Never seen a sight like this before. What can you tell us about these photos? Oops, well, looking at the wrong thing. There we go. Now I can...
Oh,
wow.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Like a rainbow.
It looks like a rainbow. But if you look at it, it looks like it's arced. I'd like to know where the sun is. My guess is the sun is up above it, is what I would guess. This looks like, you know, a lot of times you see sun dogs or halos around the sun. And this is kind of a similar type it's almost like a prism. The ice crystals are... acting like prisms and refracting the light and separating it out. But those are not, it's not a rainbow, even though we describe it as a rainbow color, because it's probably, well, it is on ice crystals. It's being formed. Those are cirrus clouds made of ice crystals. And I'm trying to remember the name of it.
Is it upper tangent arc?
Or a lower tangent arc.
Yeah, I don't know which one.
It depends on where the sun is.
Yeah,
it's
right.
It's a tangent arc.
It's a tangent arc.
It's a tangent arc,
Well, that's a cool picture.
That is really brilliant. And again, I'll bet you it was even more brilliant to the naked eye.
Yeah.
Cameras are good nowadays, but
And what really sticks out in this picture is the purples.
Yeah, right.
You
know,
a lot of times you don't see those purples. You see the yellows and the reds, but that purple is just fantastic.
And if you're not on our Facebook page already, go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and you will see that photo.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. Photo.
Pretty awesome. Robbie in Viroqua, it's on to you now. Hi, Robbie.
Hi, guys. I really appreciate the show.
Thank you.
What I'd like to know is what is the instrument and how does it work that measures dew point?
I'll tell you one, because the one that I think of, it, and it's not the only one for measuring it, but I think it's the coolest one. Mm. It's called a mirror hygrometer. And so what they do is the formation of dew is defined as when you get liquid water drops on a surface. And so what they do is they have a laser beam that have a mirror that's laying horizontal, and they have a laser beam at an angle that hits the mirror and then reflects off it, and then they have a detector on the other side. And then what they do is they just cool the mirror until dew forms. They're cooling the mirror, they're measuring its temperature. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as the dew forms, you get a whole bunch of tiny droplets on there, and then that scatters the light, it diffuses it.
Wow.
And so the detectors can no longer pick it up. And they know that at that temperature, where they can't detect that reflected light beam from the laser, is the dew point temperature because dew formed on the mirror.
Wow.
That's a great device.
Isn't that
device.
A clever idea?
That's a great device. Is there any other device that is going to give you a really accurate measurement of the dew point? I mean, the wet bulb temperature, there's a couple of other choices, but the dew point temperature,
I think that's the most accurate. Yeah.
Wow. What an interesting experimental instrument.
Those engineers are smart.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, they are. So who the heck thought that out?
Yeah.
That's amazing. Thanks, Robbie.
Okay, thank you.
Jeff in Madison, it's your turn. Hi.
Hi, it's actually Jack.
Oh, sorry.
And I had a question about the dew point pooling.
Mm.
Now, you were talking about corn and planting patterns and stuff in tornadoes.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, what about planting patterns and eliminating tornado alley? Could that ever be a possibility?
Probably not, because we're talking about local additional effects in the midst of the northern fringes of tornado alley. That is the state of Iowa and parts of northern Illinois, southern Wisconsin. Really, the main focus of tornadoes in North America and therefore in the world is sort of central Oklahoma, parts of southern Kansas, parts of northern Texas, where it's not so much a corn situation there. And they're closer to the Gulf of Mexico. So the water vapor, the dew points in those places are elevated, sometimes not as high as they are in Iowa. I'll grant you that. But they're elevated by virtue of the proximity to the Gulf of Mexico. Whereas further north, you can have a day where the dew point in St. Louis, the dew point in Carbondale, places like that will be in the low 70s, and the dew point in Dubuque is 81, with a wind from the south. So southerly winds, presumably transporting properties of the air from more southerly locations, still cannot account for how high the dew point is in Dubuque or in Des Moines. And that's the dew point pooling. So it's an additional impact for some of those places. It's not really the primal cause for Tornado Alley. So I don't think you could get away with doing that.
Yeah. Okay, and one more question.
Sure.
I'm wondering, how has the Gulf weather changed because of what happened with the oil spill and all that?
The oil spill, as it turns out, didn't have as big of an effect on the local weather as it did on the biology of the situation. Mm-hmm. And actually, I'm not even sure what the status of that is now. I mean, yeah, I have a daughter who lives in New Orleans, so I would think I should know that. But yeah, most of it, I mean, it's not. I don't think it's on the surface anymore, and that's what would really drive the interactions with the atmosphere through evapotranspiration.
Yeah, there was some concern about a year ago that maybe there'd be a chance to be less evaporation, and hurricanes that made it into the Gulf might not benefit so much from the warm Gulf of Mexico water, but that stuff gets churned up really quickly, apparently, buried from the surface.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling, Jeff, or Jack, excuse me. And now let's go to Jeff in Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Gentlemen, how are you?
Good.
Great. Thanks for calling.
I just had a comment on a recent experience. I was traveling from Denver back to Madison last week and got into a severe weather situation in Nebraska out on the road. And I would just urge people to do their homework before they decide to take a trip through a severe weather location, because we had a number of basically the storm traversed us from east to west across the state, and as we continued towards Omaha, we kept getting new cells coming from right to left across us, and we had tornado touchdowns within close proximities. It's quite stressful, and when you're out there, there's really nowhere to go in an open highway, especially when you don't understand the countryside. And the local radio will tell you by county what's happening, but we weren't familiar enough with the counties.
You don't know where you are.
No. Right.
And we have iPhones, but unfortunately, when you get in remote locations, you lose the internet and the ability to track by radar. So I'm just passing that along to people to make sure when they're going to take a day's drive or they're crisscrossing, if you go to severe weather, do your homework so you can have the option of maybe postponing a trip.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And I think there must be ways around this problem. And the one that comes to mind for me is for some of these GPS satellite companies to start taking radar data and transmitting it.
They do. Yeah.
Dynamite. Yep. So there's one way around it. The other is if you're on the highway and you're in a developing situation, it's a good thing to stop at any rest area that's available, because a lot of them now have radar displays, so you can at least get a look at where you are in relation to the severe weather. So any of those things would be helpful.
Around Kearney, Nebraska was our worst. We got into a situation where there was a heavy rain shield, and if there had been one, we probably couldn't have seen it. We did get off. We got to a location, as you said, and we were able to reassure ourselves and make a better decision.
That's good thinking.
And you're right, too. I mean, even before you leave, you can check the Severe Prediction Center, puts out outlooks for severe weather, and they put it out, 12 hours in advance, refiner, and that's what you want to do,
Yeah, and in this particular situation, I was aware that there were going to be storms, but the night before, they really hadn't added the tornadic part of it, and that kind of developed over time.
That's the problem, is forecasting the severity is really hard.
Yeah. Thanks so much, fellas.
Yeah, thanks a lot for
good
calling.
Idea.
And Dennis and Ripon, your turn. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. As a child, I always heard my parents talk about heat lightning in the summer, hot summer, sticky nights. Is there such a thing?
Yes. And what it is lightning where you don't hear the thunder. And oftentimes, thunderstorms are associated with warm, moist conditions at the atmosphere, at the lower regions of the atmosphere where we live. And so we've tended to make this association that when you see lightning, you don't hear the thunder, it's hot out. We end up calling it heat lightning. Mm. But it's not anything special. It's not any special kind of lightning. It's still generating the thunder. It's just that we can't hear it, or we can't hear where you're sitting.
So it's just as dangerous as regular lightning. If you're in,
it's just as dangerous. If
depends
if
you drive
you
off to find it.
Yeah.
If you drive off to find it, it's just as dangerous.
Yeah.
But by virtue of the fact you can't hit the thunder, it's far enough away that it's not likely to hit you.
To hit you, right? Yeah. It could be way on the horizon.
Yeah.
Okay.
Depending on where you live.
So your parents were right, Dennis.
I guess I got to learn to trust them.
Yeah.
They're a lot smarter than we think.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks again for calling. Appreciate it very much. And thank you guys. What's the weather going to be like for the next month?
Great.
Yeah, the next week is going to be really nice and summery. Yeah, 80s and 90s coming up. So pretty nice week.
Across the state?
At least in the southern half. Yeah, I would say probably the whole state. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, on that cheery note, we'll close. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
We'll have them back again, our weather guys. Steve Martin, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, also professor in atmospheric and oceanic sciences, and John Martin, professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the UW-Madison. And they come by the last Monday of every month, and so July, they'll be here, the last Monday in July. Just looking ahead to what's up tomorrow, we'll learn about stroke prevention and treatment from Dr. Matt Jensen, who's part of the UW Health Comprehensive Stroke Program. They got a great program at the UW. And so that's at 11. Then 11:45, genealogist Barbara Banks will be here to share her knowledge about how to research your family's history. Thanks for listening. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.
To Kill a Mockingbird, Harper Lee's great American novel, is enjoying its 50th anniversary republication this year. What is it about this novel, so firmly rooted in the American South, that makes it so popular the world over? I'm Jean Ferraca. Join us on the next Here on Earth. Today at 3 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Johnson Bank, a privately owned bank offering a wide range of financial services, including investment management, trust, insurance, and private banking.